Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program 353, titled Tides of Oil, Tides of Money, and Financial Safe Havens. This is being recorded on March 31st of the year 2002. I want to refer listeners to For the Record Programs 344, 345, and 346, called Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire. Those programs analyze the political, economic, military, domestic, and foreign policy aspects of September 11th and preceding and succeeding events as being inextricably linked with one another. And the analysis being presented in this program is an extension in some ways of that type of analysis. Now, in Side 1, we were taking a look at something that I think, frankly, constitutes an element of national suicide by the United States, and the American people themselves bear blame for this, the refusal to accept the fact that we've got to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, and that isn't by digging up Alaska and everything else. We've got to cut down on our oil consumption. Americans so far have appeared unwilling to do that. The Senate recently voted down a bill that would have mandated increased, more efficient gas mileage by American drivers and by American automobile manufacturers. The stated reason was that soccer moms don't want to give up their SUVs and their husbands don't want to cram themselves into little cars. Well, they may be cramming themselves in much, much smaller spaces. That happened to a lot of people in the Pentagon and the World Trade Center on September 11th. A lot of them found themselves fitted into spaces they had never imagined themselves being fitted into. We're going to be taking a look at debt and financial flows and oil flows. Specifically, we took a look inside one at the fact that the Saudi influence over the United States consists of three basic elements. One, obviously, is oil. Saudi Arabia alone has 25% of the world's proven oil reserves, and the Gulf states themselves have 65%. Continuing our dependence on foreign oil makes us vulnerable in that direct respect, obviously. Beyond that, with the Reagan and Bush administration debt financing of the 1980s, in which under Ronald Reagan, and in eight years, whereas the national debt was $900 billion when Jimmy Carter left office in 1980, it was almost $2.7 trillion when Ronald Reagan left office and the Republicans controlled the Senate for six of his 8 years in office. It was over $5 million when George Bush left office in 1992. The Saudis hold a lot of our T-bills. They help to finance our foreign debt. In turn, the Saudis have been involved in direct foreign investment in the United States. Now, I'm going to read an article from the Wall Street Journal, or part of an article, that exemplifies part of the influence of Saudi capital and beyond that, petrocapital and petrodollars in the American economy. Reading from the Wall Street Journal of Tuesday, March 12th of 2002, an article by Julia Angwin, A-N-G-W-I-N, it's called Saudi Prince Boosts Holdings in Three Stocks. This is a reference to Saudi Arabia's Prince Al-Walid, who is not only a partner of Silvio Berlusconi in his media set, he's the Italian Prime Minister and P2 member. He also, that is to say, Prince Al-Walid is an associate of Youssef Nada. And the Gulf Office, a subsidiary of Al-Taqwa, is an evidentiary tributary that connects Silvio Berlusconi with Al-Taqwa and the Clean Hands investigation. We looked at that in For the Record program number 351. In turn, bear in mind that Al-Taqwa has evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of Khalid bin Mahfouz. But what we're looking at here is the recycled oil wealth of the United States. The more we pay out in terms of petrodollars, the wealthier the Saudi states become. And in turn, in order to help to offset this outward capital flow, the United States and American corporations have been in the position of having to entice just this kind of foreign investment, which gives the Saudis a tremendous amount of added leverage over the United States. Saudi Arabia's Prince Al-Walid bin Talal said he increased his holdings in Citigroup Incorporated, AOL Time Warner Incorporated, and Priceline.com Incorporated by $1 billion during the past 6 months. The prince, who is the largest shareholder of Citigroup and ranks 11th on Forbes' list of the richest people in the world, said his purchases were prompted by the low share prices in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks and the economic downturn in the U.S. Though he has suffered significant losses from prior investments in these companies, he felt that at these levels, quote, they are ridiculously priced, unquote, he said in a telephone interview. Skipping down. When Citigroup hovered around $43, it was very tempting to me, he said. The prince said he thinks the shares, which traded at $48.90 in New York Stock Exchange composite trading at 4 p.m. yesterday, are still undervalued. I think the market still doesn't realize the potential of Citigroup, unquote. The prince also increased his stake in AOL Time Warner by $450 million, bringing his stake to about 1%, he said. Again, quoting, the price was very cheap at around $23, the prince said. AOL shares have been battered since the company failed to meet its financial targets for 2001, in part because of the advertising slump. Quote, advertising will come back again, he said. By the way, we took a look at the fact that NADA management was, according to Swiss authorities, quite possibly involved in the security speculation running up to September 11th. We took a look in For the Record 327 at the probability, or at least the possibility, that the Borman Group was centrally involved in those speculations. And I would note, as we looked at in For the Record 331, that media stocks have been significantly depressed in terms of price because of the loss of advertising revenue, making them more vulnerable to people who want to buy them up, basically. Now, note here that the prince, obviously, whose wealth comes from recycled oil money, basically, primarily U.S., please note that the prince is the largest stockholder in Citigroup and that he also has more than 1%, or about 1%, in AOL Time Warner. This gives just this individual a tremendous amount of wealth. 1% of the stock in a major corporation is a lot. If 2% or more of a major corporation's stock is traded in any one day, it's viewed as a very significant event and can depress the stock in and of itself. So when you own about 1% of a giant corporation like AOL Time Warner, it gives you a lot of power. And when you also own, for example, when you're the largest shareholder in Citigroup, and when you also have tremendous holdings elsewhere, this gives you a lot of leverage. Now, this goes to the core of one of the major elements of the discussion, namely direct foreign investment in the American economy. And note the Saudi and also Gulf oil states money in this. And bear in mind in the background, Borman Capital investment in and control of the United States. Bear in mind that the Bush family is one of the elements that we're going to be looking at in the context of a number of different examples of oil flow and of capital flow. Now, in the interests of time, I'm going to be covering a lot of ground in a relatively short period of time. I will be making references to other programs that I've talked about, other elements that I've talked about in past broadcasts. Now, we're going to be taking a look at a financial money go-round, so to speak. We're going to be taking a look at crises of international liquidity. We're going to be taking a look at a crisis at the end of World War I in the 1920s and another in the 1970s. The Bush family is invested with some of the elements. One will find, I should say, the Bush family in the context of both of the following discussions of financial liquidity. The actual investments, for example, in which the Bush family are joined with the Bin Mahfouzes and the Bin Ladens are relatively small in terms of the Bin Laden, Bin Mahfouz capital investment, but it is the type of relationship that is exemplified by the Bush family holdings in Nazi Germany, and then by extension in the Borman Organization, and by the type of relationship that is exemplified in the relationship between the Bin Mahfouz family, Bin Laden family, and the Bushes that is very, very significant in the context of the discussion. It is the institutional analysis here that is paramount. Now, end of World War I, there is a crisis that comes out of the Treaty of Versailles. Germany is required to be paying reparations to France and Britain, doesn't have the money. At the same time, powerful American investors have a lot of capital to invest. They don't want to invest it in the United States because it is subject to regulation. So they're looking for a safe haven from American financial regulation. Dulles Brothers, Alan and John Foster, senior partners with Sullivan and Cromwell, a top Wall Street law firm, are also wearing the hats of diplomats and, in Alan Dulles' case, spies. They were both at Versailles, and they helped to work out a money-go-round under the Dawes and Young plan, in which American investors would basically invest in German-heavy industry and also in German municipal bonds, and in turn, this would create a capital or money, a capital flow, and a money go round. Money would be loaned to Germany, which would then pay money to France and Britain under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, thus easing a crisis of financial liquidity. In turn, American investors, by investing in Germany, would be able to find a safe haven from American regulatory considerations, and the Dulleses and the capital flow into Germany was viewed as a solution to this. Now, as we looked at, and among other books, The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by John Loftus, and Mark Ahrens, one of the principal early investors in Germany and a early investor in the Nazi Party, was George Herbert Walker, George W.'s great-grandfather and the elder George Bush's grandfather. One of the people who was a partner with him in his investments was Prescott Bush Sr., his son-in-law. This was discussed in The Secret War Against the Jews on page 358, 359, and 360. Now, the aforementioned Alan Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell helped to mask the Bush family investments in the Harriman when he set up the Harriman 15 Holding Company. Four of the Bush companies were confiscated by the Alien Property Custodian in World War II as Nazi front companies. These were the companies whose stock was held in the Harriman 15 Holding Company. Those include the Hamburg American Line, a principal element in the Bormann Organization, and also the Union Banking Corporation, the post-war liquidation of which provided the Bush family with much of their post-war fortune. Union Banking Corporation was a joint Bush family and Thiessen family venture, the Thiessen family a primary element of the Bormann Organization, as we've looked at in the past. Heinrich Thiessen Bornemisza, by the way, has his branch of the Bormann Organization and the Thiessen Empire based in Lugano, Switzerland, which is also the base for NADA management, or was the base for NADA management. Now, another crisis of financial liquidity occurred in the 1970s when the Arab states began increasing the price of oil, this in part sequel to the 1973 Arab oil embargo. That oil embargo took place in response to the Yom Kippur War, and when the Arab states began to use the oil weapon, and after Richard Nixon basically eased the limits on the amount of oil that could be imported into the United States, this created another crisis of liquidity, as we looked at in some of our discussions with Christopher Simpson, the author of The Splendid Blonde Beast. Basically, so much money was flowing out of the United States and into the coffers of the Arab oil-producing states that one of the things that was deemed necessary was to lure the Arab investors' money back into the United States. In turn, the Saudis, longtime associates of the underground Reich, the backers of the PLO, by the way, the PLO financed by Saudi Arabia, as we've looked at in numerous programs, saw this as an opportunity to begin countering Jewish influence, unquote, in the United States. We see the Bush family involved with helping to finance Nazi Germany and investing in the Nazi Party, partly as a result of the post-World War I crisis of liquidity. Money is lent to Germany in order to enable Germany to pay off France and Britain and to enable American investors to escape or to find a safe haven from American financial regulation. In the 1970s, so much money is flowing out of U.S. coffers into the Gulf oil states' coffers, including Saudi Arabia, that it is deemed necessary to begin luring some of those petrodollars back into the American economy. That is one of the areas in which we see Prince Al-Waleed and company moving up in Citigroup and AOL Time Warner. It is also that type of investing, this paradigm, that finds the joining together of people like James R. Bath and Khalid bin Mahfouz and the bin Laden family and George W. Bush, and the joining of the bin Ladens, the bin Mahfouzes, and the Bush family, among others, in organizations like the Carlyle Group that we looked at in 347. So two crises of financial liquidity, and the solution to both results in Bush connections to, on the one hand, the Third Reich and Germany, and on the other hand, to the Saudi oil-producing states. And it is it is exemplary of these tides of capital flow and the resulting investment climate that both relationships, both the relationship between the Bush family and Germany and Nazi Germany, and the Bush family and the Saudi oil-producing elements, or the Gulf oil-producing states, it is exemplary of that. And that is its significance. Now, the United States also faces a very interesting crisis in 2002, and that is the fact that we have a current account deficit. That is the sum total of private and public debt, and ours is a record. I'm going to read an article from part of a column from the Financial Times of Wednesday, February 27th of 2002. This is an article by Martin Wolf, and it alludes to the U.S. current accounts deficit, and it alludes to what I view as basically an untenable situation for the United States. Martin Wolf titled this column "An Unsustainable Black Hole," subtitled "The U.S. Current Account Deficit Cannot Grow Indefinitely Without Undermining the Dollar's Astonishing Strength." And it is the strength of the dollar that basically is going to be presenting us with a dilemma. Now, one of the things that I noted in For the Record 344 and in 345 was that Osama bin Laden mentioned in one of his tapes, he called upon Muslims to attack American economic power. And in noting the connections that I believe to be there between the bin Laden milieu and the Bush milieu to what I call the Underground Reich, the long-term effects of September 11th and the succeeding events on the American economy and the American political landscape are paramount. One of the things that George Bush has done is to basically use September 11th to call for tax cuts. We are cutting taxes, and this is going to increase the American current accounts deficit because we are placing an increasing strain on our government. We're already back to budget deficits. He's also increasing defense spending, which in the long term is bad for the economy. This is the dynamic of the tank versus the bulldozer that I've spoken about in the past. If you're going to invest your money in tanks, basically the money is coming from government issue. If you invest your money in bulldozers, you're investing capital in such a way as to build shopping centers, factories, and things that are going to employ people who are employed by the private sector. Plus, the Bush administration, in addition to cutting taxes and placing a strain on the federal budget, is also basically trying to lure consumers into financing the American economy out of recession by going into debt, both by placing the federal government in red ink and consumers in red ink. We are going to be widening our current account deficit. Now, Martin Wolf discusses this as follows, skipping down. "This trend cannot last. The difficulty is knowing when and how it will end. But the longer the process continues, the more painful that ending is likely to be. In considering how it might finish, one must ask who is financing the deficit. The answer, strangely, is that we do not really know. The International Monetary Fund says the U.S. current account deficit was about $392 billion last year. The largest offsetting surplus was Japan's $91 billion. Newly industrialized Asian economies added $44 billion, Asian developing countries $24 billion, and oil exporters $51 billion. The European Union contributed nothing with a surplus of only $1 billion. But the world as a whole ran a notional current account surplus with itself of $182 billion. About this black hole, little can be said except that it must largely consist of unrecorded exports and so capital flight from developing countries. Japan's surplus is structural. Since their financial crises, other Asian economies have also found it difficult to absorb their high savings. Thus, there are sizable surplus savings looking for a safe home. And then noting the American dilemma in which increased government debt and increased consumer debt will increase our current account deficit. Skipping down, Martin Wolf notes, moreover, the sum of net equity inflow and net inward foreign direct investment fell from $221 billion in 2000 to an annualized rate of only $2.1 billion in the first three quarters of 2001, while net bond inflows, excluding treasury flows, ran at an annualized rate of $409 billion, up from $270 billion in 2000. This shift was not surprising given changes in equity valuations and corporate profitability, but it was also a way of hedging against valuation risks. What makes the claims relatively safe for the U.S. also makes them risky for U.S. for foreign investors. As U.S. assets become a bigger component of their wealth, they must become nervous about the currency and valuation risks. The dollar is vulnerable to such changes in sentiment. And so, again, I would note that the United States is in a very vulnerable position economically, and that by increasing defense spending and cutting taxes and luring consumers to basically go into debt in order to create a demand-based recovery from the recession, we are, in effect, committing economic suicide by increasing the American current account deficit. And this, as Martin Wolf has noted, is not going to continue indefinitely. Now, one of the things that I wonder in terms of examining the investments in the United States by some of the Islamic charities, or the presence in the United States of Islamic charities like Mercy International, the SAR Foundation, and others, is whether or not one of the questions I have is whether perhaps we are looking at an Islamic component or an extension of the Crusade for Freedom, which was an illegal domestic intelligence operation conducted after World War II, in which European fascists and Nazi elements in particular were imported into the United States to counteract the effect of, quote, Jewish influence, unquote, in the U.S. when Thomas Dewey was defeated by Harry Truman in 1948. We've discussed that at considerable length in past broadcasts, most recently in For the Record 346. The Crusade for Freedom was the godchild of Alan Dulles, overseen by Richard Nixon. The front person for it was Ronald Reagan, and the person who handled the State Department machinations to bring in these Nazis and fascists, including the Vorkommando Moscow, an SS intelligence unit, was William Casey, the manager of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, and Ronald Reagan's CIA director. What we're going to look at now is to review attempts to interdict Operation Safe Haven. Operation Safe Haven was the Treasury Department operation aimed at interdicting the Nazi flight capital at the end of World War II. And one of the principal targets of Safe Haven was Alan Dulles. The one issue, turning to The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus, the one issue upon which Roosevelt was unyielding was his insistence that after the war, the German bankers must stand in the dock at the Nuremberg war crimes trial. This is confirmed by the top-secret White House Justice Department correspondence files. Skipping down. The plan was to wait until Abbs, Krupp, Flick, and the rest of the industrialists were charged. Then, Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau would unleash the wiretap evidence showing that the Nazis had hidden their stolen assets in Switzerland with the help of Alan Dulles. The whole scandal of Western aid to the German economy would unravel. All the slights of the Standard Oil blackmail would be avenged. The sudden release of the Operation Safe Haven intercepts would force a public outcry to bring treason charges against those British and American businessmen who aided the enemy in time of war. The targets included not only the Dulles brothers, but Forrestal and major industrialists such as Henry Ford. And I would add, obviously, George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather of George W. From a prosecutor's point of view, indicting the German bankers first was a brilliant strategy. To save themselves, Hermann Abs and Hjalmar Schacht would have to reveal the whole history of their sordid dealings with companies such as Ford Motor Company. Despite the shields of Swiss banking laws and the layers of corporations that Dulles had erected, he had never anticipated that the Swiss bank codes and cables would ever become public knowledge. Roosevelt and Morgenthau would have hanged him and all his colleagues for ever breaking the power of the pirates of international finance. It was a glorious dream, yet the scheme completely fell apart because someone tipped off Dulles that he was under surveillance. Skipping ahead in the secret war against the Jews, after the safe haven investigation, which would have gone directly to the Bormann organization, was interdicted, Alan Dulles resigned from the OSS and then recruited the former director of the OSS, William Donovan, himself a Wall Street lawyer, into some of his schemes to recycle Nazi money, and they both felt that getting rid of Harry Truman in the 1948 election was essential. Returning to the secret war against the Jews, soon after the safe haven inquiry into his own Nazi money smuggling was buried, Alan Dulles resigned from the OSS and returned to New York to do what he did best, move money illegally for his clients. The old spies say that Dulles did not have to try very hard to convince OSS head William Donovan that Truman was an idiot and that the only hope for the revival of an American intelligence service was to end the Democratic Party's stranglehold on the White House in the 1948 election. Although Donovan did not know it, Dulles had conned him into serving as the front man for the Nazi money launderers. He and Sir William Stevenson from British Intelligence joined the board of directors of the World Commerce Corporation, with Alan Dulles naturally as their lawyer. The Nazi money flowed in a great circle, out of the Third Reich, through the Vatican, to Argentina, and back to, quote, democratic, unquote, West Germany. The source of the miraculous West German economic revival in the 1950s was the same money that had been stolen in the 1940s. And, of course, Thomas Dewey did not defeat Harry Truman in 1948, and so bearing in mind the crusade for freedom, turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, with the help of the Dulles-Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon. Skipping down. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. And, skipping down, in 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee. Quote, displaced fascists hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. So again, when I see some of the Islamic charities that were established in the United States in the 1980s, I wonder whether a combination of recycling of oil dollars into the United States, plus perhaps the perceived desire on, or perhaps the desire on the part of some of the same elements who were involved in the machinations after World War II to counteract Jewish influence may have been at work. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 353, Tides of Oil, Tides of Money, and Financial Safe Havens, being recorded on March 31st of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.